Welcome to Manager Tools. This week's cast, how to master your response to your engagement survey, part one. The questions this cast answers are, how do I respond to my engagement survey results? What can I do when my organization does an engagement survey? And how can I improve my engagement survey results? Answers to these questions and more in this cast. Keep listening. You may be an individual who's looking for a new role. And if you are, we recommend your use of the Manager Tools interview series. The entire process of interviewing, from preparation to follow-up, included in which is over 60 podcasts and over 20 videos, as well as a full written library of everything you need to get hired for your dream job in incredible detail. You can find more information about the interview series and purchase it online at manager-tools.com/products. In this series of casts, we'll call it this series of casts, it's going to be a many-parter. We're going to be talking about engagement surveys. And we at Manager Tools have often shared our dislike of engagement surveys. Nevertheless, we know that hundreds of thousands of managers, usually those in large organizations, but it's not necessarily specific to only large organizations, have become involved with engagement surveys when their organization decides it's time to conduct one. So, in this series of podcasts, we are going to take you through the history of engagement and how, as a manager within an organization, you can truly master the process.
This series of casts is going to include Manager Tools' history with employee engagement, the history of employee engagement, the engagement industry, the manager's experience with engagement, how to respond to an initial survey, and how to attack your engagement results. First up, let's start with Manager Tools' history regarding engagement. This guidance is coming far too late. Many people have been involved in engagement surveys for a while, and we regret that we haven't addressed it sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Our apologies. Our approach at MT has always been to create a comprehensive guide for how managers can manage anyone, anywhere. And what that has meant is that we deliver guidance for managers, which is timeless and not timely.
Mm-hmm. Now, folks, because we're starting way back at the beginning with the history of it, it's going to take us a while to get to the action, is what I'm going to say. Some of you love the actionableness of our podcast. It's going to take us a little bit to get there. And what that means is if you are a licensee, that is, you have access to the show notes, we would suggest that you access those show notes immediately so that you can read ahead in terms of getting all of the guidance more quickly than waiting for us to roll these out one by one. And if you go ahead and read them and you get ahead, by all means, you can ask us questions. If you're a licensee, give us an email, shoot us an email, you know how to get a hold of us, and we'll look at your own personal engagement documents and provide you our take and our recommendations. So, in terms of our approach, in terms of this timeless, not timely kind of approach we've taken, we've got a really good example. Our favorite example of it is our first podcast on social media. Now, our first podcast on social media was published in 2008, 15 years ago. And when we recorded it, we called that podcast the MySpace Cast, because MySpace was the dominant social media application. And obviously, it is no longer the dominant social media application. MySpace today has something like 150 employees, and Facebook and many others have eclipsed it. Facebook itself has 86,000 employees. So, to Kate's point, we've changed our approach in that we want to ensure our guidance is timeless. So, we're crafting a library of timeless guidance so that we don't have to go back and take podcasts out of the feed that are no longer applicable and no longer help you.
We ended up actually changing the title of the MySpace cast, and we only recall having done this twice. where we changed our guidance. And in this case, it was just the title. But we're here now to talk about something that it seems like maybe we're a little bit late to the party. And if we were instead, as opposed to timelessness, focus on timely things and deliver guidance on all of the latest, most popular management things, ideas, guidance that's out there, we'd not only have nothing else to do, but respond to people's faddish and ultimately ill-advised ideas, we wouldn't be able to achieve our mission of creating this library of CAS and this archive of effective techniques for all managers to use.
Mm-hmm.
It is worth noting that virtually all management guidance is trendy and faddish. Whatever you read about that is new and interesting inevitably fades. And managers don't really have time, although a lot of people try because they're afraid of failing in their role and they don't get trained,
mm-hmm.
to implement these fads. We would suggest better off ignoring the latest trend in management guidance. Virtually all of them will fade because they don't work.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So how are we to know, I guess? I mean, I feel like we're making a little bit of excuse here, but we didn't address engagement earlier because how are we to know it was going to hang out this long generally?
Mm, yeah.
Right? When guidance around engagement first became popular, so around 2000, between 2000 and 2010, and we'll talk more about its beginnings in a moment here, but when it first reared its ugly little head, manager tools ignored it as one of these another fads, right? Which, let's be clear, we still believe it is. And since then, engagement surveys have become more and more widespread. And we at Manager Tools realized that even though we disagree with the concept, many managers in many places were having to deal with their organizations paying for engagement surveys and expecting these managers to respond. So, I mean, this is Manager Tools. It's not fantasy tools. We can pretend it's going to go away. It appears to not be going away. So a better approach here is to help you guys solve it.
Mm-hmm. Recently in Things We Think We Think, which is our weekly email for licensees, we apologized for our delay in addressing this,
mm-hmm.
and committed to doing so. And we're here to do that. This is probably going to be a many-part cast.
Mm-hmm.
While we don't agree with employee engagement, we're willing to recognize that you're dealing with it, you're facing it, and you need help addressing it. So we're here to do that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the first time, right?
No, there's a lot of systems and processes that we disagree with, that we give guidance on, because even though we don't think they're effective, they're out there and people are dealing with them. There's bad performance review systems. Reviews are great. Bad reviews, not so much. And most places, they're bad. Feedback in writing. Oh, panel interviews. That's a big one we don't love. Layoffs via email or text message, heaven forbid, come to mind as some stuff that we have previously addressed because y'all have to deal with it. And we would suggest those things would be better off dying a slow, quiet death in a corner somewhere where we don't ever have to look at them again. So please, y'all, don't confuse our discussing this topic to be supportive of the concept of employee engagement. We still disagree. But because it's become more common, because it seems to have invaded so many people's lives, we're going to help so that y'all can deal with this thing and still be effective.
Yeah.
Kind of working around it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it exists. It's reality. Let's face reality and deal with it together. And Kate mentioned, we announced in Things We Think We Think rather recently that we were going to begin addressing engagement. And in result of that announcement, we ended up receiving a number of emails about this delay in doing so. And if you knew us or if you know us, we would have apologized while trying to explain why we steered clear of the topic. But we'd assumed that the commentary would be negative. That is, saying something about or suggesting that we'd not done our job and not supported our audience. But on the contrary, we got a lot of really supportive mails and notes from people suggesting that this guidance was needed and would be helpful, and thus here we are.
Yeah. We got some specific notes. Sayeda Vuk, a exceptional client, HR manager, and friend of the firm, said, before Thermal Systems, I worked at a couple of very large organizations that had big engagement surveys, follow-up, and even attached the scores to managers' compensation. Mm. In general, the process was for each manager to review their team's scores and make a plan for improvement. Simplistic, but it made sense. Managers really struggled with what that improvement plan should look like. So we ended up with team building activities that didn't move the needle very much. Classic problem. On top of that, managers took the results personally. But here are some things that I don't see in most plans that made the most difference in my experience. And this is where MT can really help managers and executives. Managers who provided feedback properly and consistently kept high engagement scores and low turnover. It's really hard to improve engagement if the company culture isn't clear. And I mean the behaviors that define the company culture, not the stuff on the wall in the lobby. Regardless of how much the manager succeeded at creating an engagement plan or goal, if the context isn't consistent, then it won't work. It will just be one more thing that we do because HR has nothing better to do. In my experience, most executives don't get this, don't sit long enough to hear it, and think they've already done it when, in fact, it's clear as mud to the rest of the organization.
Mm-hmm. That was a really good note that we got. Another community member and licensee, Lori Young, sent us a note saying, thank you for taking on the engagement discussion. We have a PECON survey every quarter that measures different aspects of engagement, some as ridiculous as whether their manager cares about their personal finances or exercise regime. These are things that managers have no direct input into and very little indirect input. I've struggled with what I can do to improve these types of measures, particularly when my boss recently told me to stop doing weekly one-on-ones because the organization wants to reduce the number of unnecessary meetings. I stood my ground and refused to cut weekly one-on-ones and pointed to engagement scores as support for why they are so necessary. That is one thing I can directly impact. One-on-ones every week with every direct are the most necessary meetings on my calendar. And Lori's note is a really good example of that tension between management ideas. That is, engagement comes along and suddenly her boss is telling her, you need to stop doing MTO3s because they're seen as unnecessary. And I mean, I might suggest the part about MTO3s where we let the directs go first would be almost the only time you could possibly show your direct that you care about their personal finances or exercise regime. But nonetheless, we'd bet Lori's boss didn't do them, and kudos to Lori, do one-on-ones, that is, and kudos to Lori for pushing back. Always remember, a boss who doesn't do one-on-ones by definition sees them as unnecessary. And P.S., we have a cast for that.
I talked to one of my directs today about exercise in our one-on-one, and they're the person who brought it up, and we talked about it.
Yeah.
And last week in our one-on-one, we talked about personal finances. I think maybe I was the one that brought it up, and we had a kind of like side conversation about personal finances and things like that. And the idea that we should have the time and space to talk about those things and also cancel meetings with our directs is...
Yeah. Where?
How? It's like cognitive dissonance.
How are we even ever going to come up with that conversation?
Am I supposed to do it in the hallway?
Yeah. So, hey, are you working out? Creepy. It seems a bit weird to say that. Yeah, right? Exactly. Immediately, I'm like, oof, that is not HR territory. Do not do that. But yeah, when else are these conversations going to come up? Cancel the only opportunity you have to have these kind of conversations that are required for engagement? It's nonsensical.
Yeah, totally. I can't imagine when those conversations.
Yeah.
In the 4 minutes that people log in early to meetings, except nobody logs in early to meetings because most people are late to all their meetings if you don't work here. Okay. We are back in our right minds about addressing things that y'all are dealing with, even if we don't love them. And we should share not just our history with employee engagement, because we've already given you that, we want to also share the history of employee engagement in general, managerially, as a trend. We usually don't do this. We don't share the history of management principles or concepts. And sure, we'll provide context in a lot of cases, and especially for the stuff that we recommend. But we believe that the more managers who understand the underpinnings of what our recommendations are, and I'm sorry for understanding underpinnings, that was fun, the more you'll be able to apply them in unusual situations. The idea of having the rationale and then being able to adapt based on the underlying principle is something we talk about a lot. I share with people often, this is why we recommend this thing, so that people can kind of extrapolate that principle or idea in case they need to make a change. Like when we talk about scheduling one-on-ones, we say, you know, this is why we don't recommend these things. And now that you know why, you might choose to override the why because your situation is different. And we do try really hard to do that. I had multiple conversations this week about this is why we would do this thing. And if you understand the principle, the idea being that you could apply the principle in the future rather than just the behavioral example. It's not enough to say, hey, do this, and then not share why that's valid, because then how are people going to know what to do next time in many cases?
Right.
But engagement's been a little bit different because the history is like maybe more relevant than usual, I think, in this case. That's why we're going to share it with y'all.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, while we know you as a manager have to respond to it, perhaps you as an executive could potentially have the opportunity to stop it before it starts within your firm.
Right. Somebody brought it up.
And having this information will help you in your conversations about why maybe us investing all this time and money into engagement surveys is less helpful than it seems at first glance.
Right. If your firm hasn't started walking into the lake, you could probably keep them on the path.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's good to take a little bit of time here and talk about management trends and fads and things like engagement. There's really a reason why these trends happen despite being bad ideas.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Folks, pre-internet, new management concepts came about in one of two ways. The first was organic. That is, some manager or executive or CEO or HR executive came up with a way to address it as an issue in the workplace. They tried it and it worked, or it didn't.
Right. So they had an issue and they said, hey, we're going to attempt this and maybe it'll solve this problem we have. So very organic, very responsive, if you will.
Lifetime experimentation on the organization itself. Yes, that's exactly
right. It's like, okay, we have a problem. We're going to try to fix it. And smart people are in the C-suite. So they say, hey, let's give this a shot. This is, as we know, a classic way
in which
change occurs. And that'll never stop. And it shouldn't, honestly, because we haven't exhausted all the good ideas that people have, clearly. And changes like this come from good ideas of smart people. Nothing more in this type of situation than individuals trying to solve their own problems. And it's called cultural adaptation, right? That we're engaging in here. Sometimes we have to adapt what's happening and as a group, which implies culture.
That's exactly it. And culture is behavior. As we've said before, in a really recent podcast, we talked all about culture is behavior. Culture is not something that's just posted on your website. The culture of humankind predates what we think of as society. Society being towns, cities, organizations, nations. And that's because humankind had to find ways to peacefully coexist before there were modern societal rules and laws of order in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And cultural adaptation is when humans interact and in that interaction, we learn from each other better ways of interacting, better ways of doing things that then spread because other people try them too, and they work for those people as well. Less efficient and or less effective ways of doing things then in turn die out.
Right, because people try the new
idea. Exactly. Right.
I've got a way to do this. I always think of it as like Pinterest can teach you how to fold a fitted sheet. And I think I was 32 before I learned how Martha Stewart folds a fitted sheet. And y'all, it works. And I stopped doing it the way that doesn't work. Right.
So all of the people that Kate's ever with who are doing laundry, Kate teaches now to do the new fitted sheet way. And now, here we go. There's a bunch more people.
That would assume that other people in my house know how to fold fitted sheets, and that's not fully accurate. And it is true that the bad ways will die out if people try the new way and the new way is good. If they try it and it's bad, okay, then it goes away, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And the idea is, okay, somebody has this idea, somebody has this new thing, and naturally the less effective thing will die out. And if that's true, then it's through billions and billions of human interactions every day that this change occurs, is communicated, is spread.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And that's exactly it.
You tell somebody, oh my gosh, I have this new way of doing this thing. Or you see somebody do something and say, oh, you know what? You could try this. What's interesting is that a lot of people really feel that the world is speeding up and we're moving so fast all the time. One of the reasons I think that people feel that is more people live in closer proximity to each other. And so you have more interactions with people. And
more opportunities to learn.
Sure. And like even I said, Pinterest, the fact that people even are able to interact with each other in ways that aren't face-to-face, because that's where this all came from was somebody, you see somebody do something and you say, oh, what about this? We have all these new fangled ways, essentially, to learn. We have increased interactions with others, increased interactions with learning platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And that increases diversity of interaction. So you could even like learn four different ways to try it and see which one is the best out of those. And it's essentially the transmission of behavior is sped up because of proximity and input. There's more inputs. You have more humans around you telling you, hey, try this.
Mm-hmm.
And you see more things. Obviously, too, travel increases that.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
There's more, it's more pervasive. There's more humans. It's faster because there's more humans. And because you have also, I think, a lot of people have a lot more free time. And that gives you the option to learn these things and spend time on them. So
exactly.
These changes were before only organic. And this is one of the organic ways that it happened before.
Exactly. And all that to say, we as managers would do well to remember that the primary and most effective way for change to occur in our organizations is this organic way that Kate's talking about, through the processes of cultural adaptation. We managers are supposed to be nodes of innovation inside of our organizations.
Mm-hmm.
The primary way our organizations improve is through individuals adding to, contributing to ideas in order to improve them then for ourselves and the organization itself. And unfortunately, many organizational cultures actively resist these types of innovation. That is, there's a powerful inertia. Objects at rest tend to stay at rest, to not allowing this kind of innovation.
And static friction.
Yeah, exactly.
Human static friction.
Exactly. And if you didn't realize it, if you change the way you manage, even as simply as changing the way you run your meetings or the way you do your one-on-ones, if you change something about the way you do the things you do, it is a form of management innovation. You're changing things is innovation. If you make changes, you are an innovator within your organization.
And y'all, we encounter this all the time. So you're probably listening to this and you're thinking, ooh, that's so exciting. I could change management. And that's true. Although I would suggest that people are kind of inherently against this idea. Like I experience in myself and in my interactions with others, human static friction every single day. The idea of, well, we've done it this way before, so we'll do it again. And to some extent, sure, it's harder to change your process. So it's easier to do what you did before. And that might be a reason that people don't want to change. I don't think people have thought it that far through, though. I don't actually believe that most people, that initial pushback to change comes from them having thought through their process versus the new one and saying, well, here's the three things that are going to make that change burdensome. I honestly believe most people, their initial response to a proposed change is no, or resistance. Maybe not a no, but definitely resistance. And even I find when people describe to me a problem, somebody tells you a problem.
Yeah.
And if you've been listening to us for a while, you've probably heard us say, sometimes people are just venting, right?
Yep.
Like, so let's not make the assumption that every conversation requires you to suggest a change, because that's not true. However, when people say, oh, I have this problem, and you suggest a solution, mm-hmm. I find people are reluctant.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that, meh, you know, they're dismissive or they're negative about the idea. And maybe they're just expressing a feeling and I should let them get three or four sentences in. I don't know. It seems a lot like when people are thinking theoretically or thinking not about their own behavior, they think, oh yeah, innovation's good. Let's talk about how we can change things and make things better. And then given the opportunity, something as simple as, hey, why don't you have your staff meeting start on time? They push back.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Tell you why. Or yesterday I said to somebody, hey, you don't have to check email all day. And that's a real hard sell,
yeah,
y'all. And what shocks me is that people complain. And then when I say to them, well, you don't have to do the thing that you're complaining about, their response to that is, yes, I do. And I don't know if it's just like, because I genuinely believe that I have to do it this way,
yeah,
I'm reluctant. Or if it's, I honestly feel like it's the same force that causes it to be hard when you first try to get the refrigerator moving. Like if you're trying to move your yeah. fridge, you have to push really, really hard at the beginning. And then it starts to slide. Yeah. This human static
yeah.
friction is one of the biggest like forces I see against innovations mm-hmm. like this happening, which is fun. It's funny that some of it makes huge traction.
Right.
Like how did engagement get such big traction if most people are so reluctant to unstick themselves from their norm?
That's the thing. And organizations claim they desire these changes, these innovations.
Just like individuals.
Right?
People
they
say,
do.
Oh, companies say, we want change.
Exactly. When it comes to management, organizations say they love innovation, but they generally don't mean it.
Not based on what we see, right?
Not based on what we see. Now, when we talk about individuals like your CEO definitely wants you to innovate. They want you to try new things, to be more effective. But let's face it, there are some powerful interests between you and your CEO who don't want you to innovate or change your managerial behaviors or improve things on your own. They want you to wait until they train you on something that the organization wants you to do. We want you to get better, but we want you to wait for us to teach you how to get better and then do the thing only the way we taught you to do it.
You know, it's really funny, and I know you've seen it. You saw the Air movie, right?
Yes.
And I did too. And one of the things that struck me in that movie, partially because I just saw it and we were talking about this cast in the same space as having seen the movie. One of the big tensions in that movie for me, and I'm sure very few people had this experience of that movie. It's fantastic, by the way, y'all. One of the tensions for me in that movie was that the core values of the organization printed on the uh-huh. wall were fully what Matt Damon's character was trying to do. And at the same time, the CEO, Ben Affleck's character, is resistant. He's reluctant. Don't do that. You can't do that. And so that tension.
Yeah.
The movie plays into it, right? They show you Nike's core value. They didn't call it that, but they're printed all over the movie. They're shown, they're displayed as visuals. Mm-hmm. It was starting to feel very stressful for me, that tension between
yeah.
these printed things and this is what you're asking him to do via these core values. And yet there was a, again, that human static friction,
yeah.
which if there's a bunch of people doing it, becomes organizational static friction mm-hmm. against change and innovation.
Exactly.
And this guy is just like beating at the, up against that. And people keep saying no, when in fact, that is how Nike was completely created.
Yeah.
Like this was, that's how the whole thing
yeah.
was created. So of course, CEOs given, be if they were asked, hey, do you want this? They would of course say yes.
Of course.
Because that's so many times how the organization was created. And it's innovation into new markets that creates new revenue streams when old ones fail. It's like, what did Jack Ma, Jack Ma said, if we don't destroy our business, someone else will. The idea being that someone else will come along and say, there's a better way of doing this, and they'll create it. And then the market share of the previous idea will fade and slow and wither on the vine, essentially. So
yeah.
your CEO does want you to do it.
They
and
do.
Then there's all these levels, like you said, powerful interests. And not only there are these powerful interests there, they also, they there's this human, and I know I keep saying it, y'all, it's just that, you know, when you have these moments where like all of these ideas coalesce into one core idea, which is human static friction may be one of the most insidious silent killers
yeah.
of innovation, change, and creation in organizations. Like,
yes, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. If you think you're going to say no, just pause, breathe, and think to yourself, like, should I say no?
Right. It's almost habitual. It's almost a habit for people to push against innovation and change, right? In terms
yeah.
of our organizations. They want you to innovate while wanting you to wait until they train you on something that the organization wants you to do. And that's despite the fact that the training that managers usually get doesn't even teach them specific behaviors on what to change.
Or even how to do the most core things.
Right.
Most of the people I know didn't learn how to run a meeting. No one was ever trained. Mm-hmm. Like if you ask people, how many of you were trained? To run a meeting. Think about that. Were you trained ever to run a meeting? The majority of people, professionals, even mature professionals that I know were not trained. And yet if you try to change the way meetings are run, people push back.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you haven't even been trained. So sometimes it's that they want to train you. Sometimes it's they don't even get to it. And then they tell you not to do this other thing.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I guess we're being a little cynical. I don't know.
No, but what they want, they want the organization to change. And it's cute. It's funny, given that most management training isn't helping managers. It's to help the organization achieve its desires. And this is another one of those things.
And that's not inherently bad. We support, and we've talked about this, y'all, about results retention. Results is your primary obligation. Your primary obligation is to the organization. It's not inherently bad. That training is meant to help the organization achieve its desires.
We're here for the organization, to serve the organization.
Yeah. And companies should have a role in our development. And we ask them to support managers being developed. The problem, though, is that the training that they may give you, if they do train you, on the organization's efforts won't, in most cases, have been broken down into specific actionable stuff. Like,
yeah.
do this, do this, do this. And okay, listen, this is really, really, really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Because if managers don't know what to change and how, it's unlikely that people are going to do that. If you don't know how to do something, if you don't have a playbook, if you don't have a series of steps, then, I mean, honestly, is there a big chance that you're going to set up a plan for that? Most of the time, we're so busy making plans for other stuff, we don't have a lot of time to create plans for change. And I would even suggest that a lot of us, the biggest changes that we've gone through historically, professionally, have been organic.
Yeah.
They weren't planned. It was one decision gets made, the next decision gets made, then the next. And suddenly you're in a waterfall of change
mm-hmm.
that was, frankly, not intended always. Here's the tricky part about that, though, y'all. If we go back to the idea of culture being behavior, the organization won't change if the managers don't change.
Exactly.
So being able to make decisions and assist managers and train them, great. But if it doesn't have a clear path forward, I'm going to suggest that managers don't know how to do it. Then they can't do it or they won't do it. And so the organization stays Just the way it is.
Just the way it is. Exactly.
Yeah, just the way, which you may not love. You're, what is that quote? Be the change that you wish to see in the world. Mm-hmm. There's a Michael Jackson reference in there somewhere, but I've already used enough tangents today. For those of you whose role requires PDUs and those of you who are involved in the PMI group, we want to let you know that our public conferences, both in person and virtual, are now certified with PMI PDUs. We'd love to host you either in person or online for a public conference event where you can earn the credits you might need to meet some of your professional certification obligations. We'd love to see you there. Come to www.manager-tools.com/training.
So, in terms of organizations stating their desire for change and then not helping individual managers do it, this is why, in some cases, these organizational efforts in turn come with consulting engagements to drive large change throughout the overall organization. To our point, instead of training the individual managers, this is what you do. Rather, it's let's get a consultant in here. Let's have that consultant tell us what to do in terms of changing our overall organization. And yet still, those consultants you will work with will not be able to give you specifics if you do end up working directly with one. That's the thing. I mean, they're going to come in, they're going to help your overall organization improve and still not give anybody in the organization specifics about what needs to come next. And that's the kind of detail that makes these engagements incredibly expensive and 110% ineffective in any beneficial organizational change whatsoever.
Right. The level of detail necessary is insanely expensive. And so not a lot of companies can afford it, even though it'd be fantastic for the managers to go through that type of process. The thing is, I do want to say this, y'all. It's not necessary that a consultant be the person who suggests change. This has been a common kind of running theme the last, a few months in our cast of we're really trying to remind managers of their autonomy. You have a lot of autonomy, y'all. You can decide, hey, you know what? I think management should be done a little bit differently around here. So I'm going to make some tweaks. We've talked about this in a few different topics recently about, hey, y'all, you're the people who create the change. So just a gentle reminder again about your own autonomy. And I suppose maybe this is the wrong audience for that because this is specifically an audience probably who came here searching for ways to change. And so perhaps you would like then to share this podcast with someone you know who's resistant to change. Right. Because if you're here listening, you might be like us in assuming that you have some autonomy to create the environment and therefore the behavioral situation and culture that you want to exist in.
Exactly. That's all for this week, folks. Join us again next week for a continuation of this series.